This is Audible.
Random House Audio presents The Broker by John Grisham. Read for you by Michael Beck. Chapter 1. In the waning hours of a presidency that was destined to arouse less interest from historians than any since perhaps that of William Henry Harrison, 31 days from inauguration to death, Arthur Morgan huddled in the Oval Office with his last remaining friend and pondered his final decisions. At that moment, he felt as though he had botched every decision in the previous 4 years, and he was not overly confident that he could, somehow so late in the game, get things right. His friend wasn't so sure either, though as always, he said little, and whatever he did say was what the president wanted to hear. They were about pardons. Desperate pleas from thieves and embezzlers and liars, some still in jail, and some who'd never served time, but who nonetheless wanted their good names cleared and their beloved rights restored. All claimed to be friends or friends of friends or diehard supporters, though only a few had ever gotten the chance to proclaim their support before that 11th hour. How sad that after 4 tumultuous years of leading the free world, it would all fizzle into one miserable pile of requests from a bunch of crooks. Which thieves should be allowed to steal again? That was the momentous question facing the president as the hours crept by. The last friend was Kritz, an old fraternity pal from their days at Cornell when Morgan ran the student government while Kritz stuffed the ballot boxes. In the past 4 years, Kritz had served as press secretary, chief of staff, national security advisor, and even secretary of state, though that appointment lasted for only 3 months and was hastily rescinded when Kritz's unique style of diplomacy nearly ignited World War III. Kritz's last appointment had taken place the previous October, in the final frantic weeks of the re-election onslaught. With the polls showing President Morgan trailing badly in at least 40 states, Kritz seized control of the campaign and managed to alienate the rest of the country, except, arguably, Alaska. It had been a historic election. Never before had an incumbent president received so few electoral votes. 3, to be exact, all from Alaska, the only state Morgan had not visited at Kritz's advice. 535 for the challenger, 3 for President Morgan. The word landslide did not even begin to capture the enormity of the shellacking. Once the votes were counted, the challenger, following bad advice, decided to contest the results in Alaska. Why not go for all 538 electoral votes, he reasoned. Never again would a candidate for the presidency have the opportunity to completely whitewash his opponent, to throw the mother of all shutouts. For 6 weeks, the president suffered even more while lawsuits raged in Alaska. When the Supreme Court there eventually awarded him the state's 3 electoral votes, he and Kritz had a very quiet bottle of champagne. President Morgan had become enamored of Alaska, even though the certified results gave him a scant 17-vote margin. He should have avoided more states. He even lost Delaware, his home, where the once-enlightened electorate had allowed him to serve 8 wonderful years as governor. Just as he had never found the time to visit Alaska, his opponent had totally ignored Delaware. No organization to speak of, no television ads, not a single campaign stop, and his opponent still took 52% of the vote. Kritz sat in a thick leather chair and held a notepad with a list of 100 things that needed to be done immediately. He watched his president move slowly from one window to the next, peering into the darkness, dreaming of what might have been. The man was depressed and humiliated. At 58, his life was over, his career a wreck, his marriage crumbling. Mrs. Morgan had already moved back to Wilmington and was openly laughing at the idea of living in a cabin in Alaska. Kritz had secret doubts about his friend's ability to hunt and fish for the rest of his life. But the prospect of living 2,000 miles from Mrs. Morgan was very appealing. They might have carried Nebraska if the rather blue-blooded First Lady had not referred to the football team as the Sooners. The Nebraska Sooners. Overnight, Morgan fell so far in the polls in both Nebraska and Oklahoma that he never recovered. And in Texas, she took a bite of prize-winning chili and began vomiting. As she was rushed to the hospital, a microphone captured her still famous words, "How can you backward people eat such a putrid mess?" Nebraska has 5 electoral votes. Texas has 34. Insulting the local football team was a mistake they could have survived, but no candidate could overcome such a belittling description of Texas chili. What a campaign! Kritz was tempted to write a book. Someone needed to record the disaster. Their partnership of almost 40 years was ending. Kritz had lined up a job with a defense contractor for $200,000 a year, and he would hit the lecture circuit at $50,000 a speech, if anybody was desperate enough to pay it. After dedicating his life to public service, he was broke and aging quickly and anxious to make a buck. The president had sold his handsome home in Georgetown for a huge profit. He had bought a small ranch in Alaska where the people evidently admired him. He planned to spend the rest of his days there, hunting, fishing, perhaps writing his memoirs. Whatever he did in Alaska, it would have nothing to do with politics and Washington. He would not be the senior statesman, the grand old man of anybody's party, the sage voice of experience. No farewell tours, convention speeches, endowed chairs of political science, no presidential library. The people had spoken with a clear and thunderous voice. If they didn't want him, then he could certainly live without them. "We need to make a decision about Cuccinello," Kritz said. The president was still standing at a window looking at nothing in the darkness, still pondering Delaware. "Who?" "Figgy Cuccinello, that movie director who was indicted for having sex with a young starlet."
"How young?"
15, I think."
"That's pretty young."
"Yes, it is. He fled to Argentina, where he's been for 10 years. Now he's homesick, wants to come back and start making dreadful movies again. He says his art is calling him home."
"Perhaps the young girls are calling him home."
"That too.
17 wouldn't bother me. 15's too young."
"His offer is up to $5 million.
The president turned and looked at Kritz. "He's offering $5 million for a pardon?"
"Yes, and he needs to move quickly. The money has to be wired out of Switzerland. It's 3 in the morning over there."
"Where would it go?"
"We have accounts offshore. It's easy."
"What would the press do?"
"It would be ugly."
"It's always ugly."
"This would be especially ugly."
"I really don't care about the press," Morgan said.
"Then why did you ask?" Kritz wanted to say.
"Can the money be traced?"
the president asked, and turned back to the window.
"No."
With his right hand, the president began scratching the back of his neck, something he always did when wrestling with a difficult decision. 10 minutes before he had almost nuked North Korea, he'd scratched until the skin broke and blood oozed onto the collar of his white shirt.
"The answer is no," he said. 15 is too young."
Without a knock, the door opened and Artie Morgan, the president's son, barged in, holding a Heineken in one hand and some papers in the other. "Just talked to the CIA," he said casually. He wore faded jeans and no socks. "Maynard's on the way over." He dumped the papers on the desk and left the room, slamming the door behind him. Artie would take the $5 million without hesitation, Kritz thought to himself, regardless of the girl's age. 15 was certainly not too young for Artie. They might have carried Kansas if Artie hadn't been caught in a Topeka motel room with 3 cheerleaders, the oldest of whom was 17. A grandstanding prosecutor had finally dropped the charges 2 days after the election, when all 3 girls signed affidavits claiming they had not had sex with Artie. They were about to, in fact, had been just seconds away from all manner of frolicking when one of their mothers knocked on the motel room door and prevented an orgy. The president sat in his leather rocker and pretended to flip through some useless papers.
"What's the latest on Bachman?" he asked. In his 18 years